Good afternoon. I'm going to present some research that is part of the Pine Integrated Network Education Mitigation and Adaptation Project, or Pine Map. This is one of the projects that was funded by USDA in 2011 as part of their initiative for climate adaptation projects. I have a whole host of co-authors, that's why they weren't on the first page. And PineMap overall is a very large project. There were 51 investigators involved, PIs, and several dozen, I didn't count them all up, graduate students, undergraduates, and staff involved. And if, for those of you who are familiar with the Southeast United States, you know that those universities and some of the people associated with them, University of Florida, Virginia Tech, University of Georgia, are the homes of research cooperatives. And PineMap is really born out of the long-standing relationships between industry, universities, and U.S. Forest Service in the form of the research cooperatives at these various universities. Oklahoma State made measurements as part of this group. So the study area and the study population is, for PineMap, all of the Southeast United States and the loblolly pine plantations located within there. Now, I say that somewhat facetiously because actually the study populations are the research installations that were put in by the research cooperatives. What you're seeing here, this Google Earth image, is the natural range of loblolly pine, and this research is focused on loblolly pine plantations, not natural forests, and so we don't have any comparisons to natural forests, nor sort of unmanaged run-of-the-mill forest by your non-industrial private landowners. Just a little bit about PineMap's overall design. We're interested in carbon cycling and the sensitivity of these pine plantations to climate change. And the way this was examined with a three-tier network, the first two tiers drew heavily from the research cooperatives and their network of research sites. First one is forest growth and climate, silviculture, and genetics. That was, I think, upwards of 450 different research sites were pulled out of that network. I'll be talking about the Tier 2 network, which is focused on forest carbon response to silvicultural treatments. And the third tier was some research installations that were put in where through-fall excluders and fertilization were applied in a factorial design. So I'm going to focus on the second tier of research sites in this talk. So from that, the networks of sites that were put in by the research cooperative, 123 distinct sites were drawn. These sites had different levels of replication within them, and we sampled about 450 plots overall. Usually within a given site, there was one treatment representative sampled. So we didn't measure replication within an experimental design at a given site. My group actually did that as part of a student's thesis, but overall, we're just talking about site-level replicates, and so therein is the reason why we say we're sampling a population. The range in temperatures, for those of you not familiar with this region, anywhere between 14 to 21 degrees Celsius. What you're looking at here is precipitation, which ranges between 1,100 and 1,800 millimeters throughout the region. So the way that we examined these research installations was in the context of binary groupings. So chemical competition control, fertilization or FERT, and then thinning. This is the breakdown of the sites. The largest overall component of the research designs was chemical control plus fertilization, a very common silvicultural approach in the Southeast United States, followed by those two and thinning, or the all treatment. We had very few no treatments within this design, meaning or controls, which is somewhat typical of industrial forest management these days, where there isn't much being planted that isn't also receiving some level of silvicultural treatment. One thing I won't be talking about is contrast between high and low nitrogen or high and low phosphorus, because there's a large number of treatment combinations once you start breaking down into that level of detail that are a function of the different goals and study designs of the various research cooperatives. And just for an example, I put up, you know, if I just looked at fertilization amounts and the timing of a fertilizer application, there are actually 322 different treatment combinations within that component of the design. So really just looking at competition control, fertilization, and thinning. We measured everything. With that many people, you have to measure everything, right? So that's what we did. Buffer on biomass and coarse roots were actually provided by the research cooperatives through their mensurative data and then allometric equations that were specific to the region in Loblolly Pine. Soil samples, we measured down to 1 meter, 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 50, and then 5100. Roots and woody debris within those intervals were also sampled. Forest floor, litter and duff. I worked in Canada for a while, so I still like to say litter and duff. OI and OEA. No, I don't need to say that to most of you. Fine roots, understory, and then coarse woody debris. So this is just an overview of the carbon distribution for about 115 sites. I actually eliminated a few sites where the trees were very young, just so we could get a sense of what at a little past mid-rotation you might see in a typical forest in the southeast U.S. On average, soil carbon at this point is the largest pool, followed by tree biomass. Forest floor is about 10 to 20%, depending on where you are. Roots, soil detritus, understory, and coarse woody debris. There's very, very little coarse woody debris in these systems, primarily, especially at this age, primarily because the wood decomposes very quickly and they don't really go through a lot of self-thinning in an intensively managed scenario. So these are 17 years of age, so the tree biomass is, on average, the tree biomass is less than what we'd expect at the end of rotation. So, you know, continuing over a number of years, you might see, you know, greater tree biomass than soil carbon in these systems. So with that many sites and that many research plots, we ended up with a lot of data. So there is about 3,000 different soil carbon and nitrogen estimates. We measured six different soil orders. This is what you're looking here, the averages by soil order. So the largest number of samples came out of ultisols, followed by alphasols, and then spodosols. But we also had a fair representation of entosols and inceptosols. There really were only two or three vertosols overall. And these are typical patterns. Really what I'm doing is making a case that soon, probably in the next couple of years, this data, this 3,000 individual measurements from that region will be available to everyone through TerraC or PineMap. So just keep your eyes open if you're interested in this type of data, and once we have our stuff published, and it'll be free to anyone to use. And the other reason I wanted to bring up the 3,000 data points is that we learned through the process of doing this and comparing to some NRCS, we sampled up to two-thirds of what NRCS has sampled for that region in forest soils. So we did that in 3 years. And that's not a disparagement of NRCS, but it's just testament that we can use undergraduates. So the analysis I'm going to show is pretty straightforward and simple. We did a pair plot analysis where we had at each site, this is from the research cooperative this is from the research cooperative at the University of Georgia, Athens. And what you're looking at is an experiment where they're looking at thinning combined with S, which is spraying for competition control, and F for fertilization control. So at this site, I would have one pair where I'm comparing S plus F to the control, for example. This will make more sense in a little bit and show the contrast. Also did a real simple correlation analysis where I looked at the change in tree biomass and how that corresponded to a change in either the forest floor or the soil carbon. Those other pools are so small, I'm not going to focus on them in this talk. So just to kind of put some bounds around this a little more. So for the three different main treatments, Thinning, which is up over here on the left, you know, will contrast a treatment where it's thinned and not thinned, and there's no chemical or fertilization control across that main comparison. And there's fairly good replication. You know, 123 sites, you think we have good replication, but really the number of replicates sort of centered in on where most of the management is done in these systems. So, for example, where we have thinning applied with chemical and fertilization control or not, you know, that has an N of 24. If we go down to fertilization, where we've done thinning, chemical control, and then fertilization, yes or no, that has an N of 32. Okay, so the design is not perfectly balanced. And then we have some that under chemical and fertilization where we only had an N of 1. And, of course, it doesn't make any sense to do that comparison. So what you're looking at here is soil carbon to 1 meter. And this is the centered values. So chemical control is on the first series of results. And if it's positive, that means there's more soil carbon when there's chemical control applied with, for example, fertilization plus thin, which is that first left value. And then the N is just the number of paired plots within each comparison. And I'm showing the full 1 meter rather than each one of the profiles because I did do that analysis, of course, 0 to 10, 10 to 20, and there are about 25% of those paired plots are significant. But what happened was, which is interesting and very informative, I think, for those of us who measure soils, although, again, you are all measuring soils, so you know what I'm talking about, is if you look at 10 to 20 and you have a significant result, if you add the 0 to 10 and then look again at that combined pool, there's no significant result, right? That happens way too often. And the reason I have highlighted here the thinning plus chemical, the one with the N of 8 with a P of 0.059, that's the one where the horizon above was consistent with the significant horizon below. So over on the right-hand side, the depth interval shown up there, the depth of 50 to 100 centimeters, that was a significant result, and we're looking at the distribution of the data. It's not beautiful. You know, there's only an N of 8 within that group, but for the 20 to 50 centimeters, it was nearly significant, and it was consistent in terms of the direction relative to the deeper horizon. I don't have a pointer here, but just to give you reference, the deeper horizon or the deeper horizon is not as well distributed as the next upper horizon. So the 50 to sorry, I'm going to make one more point. The 50 to 100 centimeter horizon was significant. You can kind of see that with that green box down at the bottom. That's a 95% confidence interval. All right. So this is for the forest floor carbon. Again, if you have a positive value, that means that chemical control is bringing in a positive tendency in combination with those other components like thinning, fertilization, or chemical thinning. And there's a trend there. And this is the one place where we see fertilization having a positive effect on forest floor carbon. The big driver is thinning. Now, forest floor carbon isn't a big pool, so the loss of that isn't a large loss to overall system carbon. And you might consider that actually a positive thing if you're thinning to try to increase nutrient cycling and productivity. So just to end up here with the correlation approach and then move into the summary, one of the reasons I did this is that many of our treatment plots were high versus low fertilization and everything else was the same. And so in a binary analysis, they weren't really able to be analyzed. And so, you know, many of the non-significant results will show up on this. So on the x-axis is the change in tree biomass as a result of some silvicultural treatment. So thinning, of course, drives a negative tree biomass, and fertilization will increase a positive will bring about a positive trend in biomass. And you see soil carbon doesn't respond. Over on the right-hand side, we're seeing that if you increase the amount of tree biomass, you increase the amount of forest floor. So thinning does seem to decrease forest floor carbon for multiple treatment combinations. There does seem in one treatment combination to be a decrease in soil carbon at 5,100 centimeters. We're doing some follow-up analysis of the actual soil characteristics to take a look at that. And if you increase biomass, you increase forest floor carbon, but there's no consistent change in soil carbon. And just acknowledgments, USDA, of course, and then the Forest Research Cooperatives that really made this all happen. Thanks.